At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Corporate crime and its ramifications on the broadcast today. Alleged crimes, we should say. Real people and the president's speech and more Oklahoma 2 months on. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, this is the Marketplace podcast for Thursday, the 25th of July. Good as always to have you with us. We begin today with the Marketplace crime blotter and the Department of Justice. The DOJ did something interesting this morning. It filed criminal charges against a prominent and profitable hedge fund named SAC Capital, owned by the equally prominent and profitable billionaire named Stephen A. Cohen. Some former SAC traders have pleaded guilty to insider trading, but now SAC itself is accused of having sanctioned that misconduct for more than a decade and intentionally hiring people who had a, quote, edge. That's SAC speak, apparently, for insider contacts. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith has the story.
SAC Capital has made a lot of money for its investors, with returns of 30% a year. At a press conference today, government regulators said part of the reason for those eye-popping returns was eye-popping criminal activity.
So SAC became a veritable magnet for market cheaters.
Now regulators want to hold the hedge fund accountable. John Coffey directs the Center on Corporate Governance at Columbia University.
We can't put corporations in prison, but they are subject to a variety of reputational penalties. On Wall Street, if you acquire a stigma, you are essentially out of business.
Like the Galleon Group, a hedge fund whose boss was convicted of insider trading in 2011. If SAC Capital is found guilty, it could have its business charter revoked, says Max Wolf, chief economist for Greencrest Capital. But just the charges are enough to sink the company, says Wolf.
You either cease to be in business or you have a long, slow rebuilding process in which, at very best, you're a sort of desiccated shadow of your former self.
Many of SAC Capital's clients have already withdrawn their money, but its biggest client is hanging in, company founder Stephen Cohen.
There's nothing to stop him from managing his own money, which is a considerable $10 billion.
Cohen hasn't been criminally charged, and he's denied wrongdoing. An SAC Capital spokesman said today the company has never encouraged, promoted, or tolerated insider trading. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
The stock of the day today is Facebook. FB shares up 29.5%, 29.5% after the company reported a big jump in quarterly revenues yesterday afternoon. A lot of that revenue, about $650 million worth or so, came from the sale of mobile ads. And that is worth a moment because the big knock on Facebook has been its inability to make money on mobile. Marketplace's Noel King reports.
$656 million in mobile ad sales in the second quarter. So, obviously, Facebook has proved skeptics wrong.
wouldn't go that far.
Melissa Parrish, an analyst at Forrester Research, says Facebook's second quarter numbers are impressive, but don't quite prove anything just yet.
Though it appears that consumers, Facebook members, are clicking on the ads and they are downloading apps as a result, we do not know how the ads are being perceived by Facebook users.
Users who might get tired of the ads and turn away from Facebook altogether. Users like Michael Pachter of Wedbush Securities. He was one of those analysts who was skeptical of Facebook's ability to do mobile ads right. He's also on Facebook, and he did a little experiment recently.
I unliked everything except 12 pages just to see what would happen. And among those are McDonald's and Cirque du Soleil and Porsche and Pepsi.
And
I get really good-looking Porsche ads and really interesting Cirque du Soleil ads, and I find myself attracted to them. I look at them and I actually click through.
Of course, Pachter realizes his experience is only anecdotal evidence. He and other analysts are still waiting to see how Facebook's mobile ads perform over the long term, but for the moment, it seems the social network has found a winning mobile formula. I'm Noel King for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, the major indices squeaked out a win. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. This week makes it 2 months since the tornado in Moore, Oklahoma. We've been following the lives of some of the people who were hit by that storm, including two women who were strangers, but who lived in the same neighborhood and who each lost their home and everything inside. The big difference between them before the tornado hit had been their finances. Natural disasters are said to be great equalizers, but for these two women, Michelle and Cindy are their names, their different financial backgrounds are making for some very different recoveries. Marketplace's Chrissy Clark has the story from the Wealth and Poverty Desk.
From new addresses, to new shoes, to new underwear, to new friends, it's hard to fit into just one radio story how much the tornado has changed both Cindy and Michelle's lives. So for this story, I'm going to focus on one part of their lives, namely their livelihoods. Let's start with Cindy, Cindy Beam. For years, she had a good $20 an hour job at the local gas company. She was one of those people you get to by pressing zero.
To speak with one of our friendly representatives, press zero.
But eventually, Cindy got burnt out. So she saved up money, and this spring, just before the tornado, she quit.
God stirred my soul and gave me the means financially, and even though part of it was coming from Dad, to take some time off and to take my time before looking for another job.
And taking time off is exactly what Cindy was doing when the tornado came and obliterated her house in May. And she suddenly had to figure out where to live, how to file insurance claims, how to get donations, and how to replace all her worldly possessions. Back then, she told me something that surprised me.
If I had a job at the moment that I had to report to every day, I wouldn't have time to do all this. There are going to be some people who are going to be taking care of these details that I'm going to get done with within a few weeks that they have to spread out over months. At this point in time, me being unemployed is a blessing.
And blessings sometimes have a way of multiplying. Not needing a job right away allowed Cindy to focus efforts on finding help for herself. And that actually led to a job. Doing
disaster relief coordination, just trying to fill in the gaps for some people that are sort of going to fall through the cracks if no one steps up to help them.
It's a temporary gig for her church, part-time, 25-ish hours a week, $10 an hour. Along with the insurance money she's getting for her house and all the donations she's received, it helps her cover expenses. And she's getting paid to do for others what she'd already been doing for herself.
How you doing?
Okay.
And here's where the story takes a weird twist. One of the people Cindy's helped recently...
What else can we do for you at this point?
...was Michelle, the other woman this story is about. Cindy learned of Michelle in the first story I did right after the tornado, which featured both of them. Michelle is a single mom with a low-paying job and no renter's insurance. And before the tornado, she'd been in a domestic violence incident, which is why she's asked not to use her last name. When Cindy heard all this on the radio, she wanted to reach out. So in late June, she invited Michelle to her church to give her some money raised by the congregation.
Go ahead and take that.
Okay.
Check from the church.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
The meeting was awkward, but sweet. They talked about what they have in common, like the weird feeling of suddenly needing charity.
To actually accept help is hard.
And I know that feeling too.
They talked about the more surprising post-tornado inconveniences, like how all the tiny but sharp debris still left in the roads keeps puncturing people's tires.
I drive through what used to be home, and within 12 hours, I have 2 flat tires.
I'm surprised I haven't yet.
And then Cindy realized the service was about to start.
So do you want to go find a seat or meet some people?
Sure.
Okay.
After the service, Michelle had to rush off to an appointment for work, which brings us to Michelle's livelihood. For the last 4 years, Michelle has been working for the census, doing door-to-door surveys for about $10 an hour. In the weeks after the storm, she was frantically juggling work with repairing all those flat tires, looking for a new place to live, making endless trips to donation centers. She missed a few deadlines for her job.
My supervisor had said, don't worry about it, get it done, and that right after the tornado, quite a few weren't working at all.
But then Michelle got sick, partly stress, partly not eating well, partly because some stitches she needed after the tornado got infected.
Everything was getting more and more crazy, and I just wasn't getting the work done.
And then Michelle's cell phone got cut off. No money for the bill. Once a friend paid it, she got this voicemail.
I know you've been having some difficulties, but you can call me.
It was from her supervisor at the census's regional office in Denver.
I'm calling because you have not responded in a week and there's no transmission. So I'm going to need you to call me so that we can pick up your computer since you're not using it. And if I don't hear from you, we're going to have to call RO and they may have the law enforcement come get it from you.
Michelle took this to mean that she no longer had a job. She had a friend send her equipment back while she was in the hospital. I called the census, and they wouldn't discuss personnel matters, but they issued a statement on Monday saying Michelle was still an employee at the time of the statement. They told me that for security purposes, they ask for equipment to be sent back if an employee is out due to an extended illness or other extenuating circumstance. I told Michelle this, thinking it would be good news. But she sounded defeated. Even if she did technically still have a job, she wondered how fit she was to do it since the tornado.
It's been 2 months. Everything's supposed to be all better. Everything's supposed to be normal now. I don't know what normal is anymore.
I'm Chrissy Clark for Marketplace.
This is day 2 of President Obama's economic roadshow. Jacksonville, Florida was the stop today. The president's message is in reality for Congress, even though he's talking in theory to real people as he gets out and about. So we figured it'd be a good idea to check in with a real person that we know and talk to from time to time, trucker Don Holshue. We got him the way we usually do on a cell phone off the side of a highway someplace. Mr. Holshue, it's good to talk to you again, sir.
Well, thank you for calling.
Tell me where we tracked you down, first of all.
Well, I'm next to the town of Charles City, Iowa, which is a north central part of the state.
Did you happen to catch the president's speech yesterday about the economy and the middle class?
Caught a little bit of it, and I like the campaign speech.
Yeah.
That's all it was, and it's kind of disappointing.
His theme was the economy's getting better. We're adding jobs. We're going to grow the middle class. You feeling any of that?
No, it's the same, except for things keep going up, and like my wages are going down. We had on my route 3 stores go out of business, so that means less money for me. Everybody's feeling the pinch.
When you stop and make your deliveries and you talk to people, you talk to owners of these hardware stores, right? That's what you deliver to. What are they saying?
They say it's, you know, it was okay. You know, I do in the rural area, so a lot of stuff is, you know, geared for repair and painting and, you know, and it's a little bit better for income.
What do you think when you see the stock market going up and big Wall Street banks profiting and corporate America making billions of dollars?
Well, it's nice that they're making billions, but, you know, you have Detroit, who's, $13 billion in debt, you know, bankrupt. I think last time I talked to you, you said, well, what would you do to change the economy? And I I break up all these big companies are getting some competition and start adding some jobs like it's supposed to be.
What about money out of your pocket? What are you paying for gas these days and groceries? You feeling anything there?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Where I live in Minneapolis, so I'm fortunate I can use a bicycle to get around, plus I don't like driving. But, I mean, gasoline is high.
Did you just say you don't like driving and you're a truck driver?
Yeah. Well, after 4 million miles, you get tired of everything.
Is that what you have 4 million miles?
I got 36 years of driving. I'm approaching 4.5 million miles of safe driving.
Safe driving. Accident-free?
Accident-free.
So what's your guess, Mr. Holshue, about where this economy goes? I mean, if you look at the numbers, you know, the economy's growing and jobs are being added. But my sense from talking to you just now is that you don't have a lot of hope.
No, it's the same old, we're in the norm. And, you know, I hate to say this, people up on the top, including the president, they don't know anything about work. You know, like what working people are going through or the middle class. Yeah, they just don't understand what work is.
Don Holshue, our trucker out in Iowa. We got him on the road in north central Iowa. Thanks a lot for your time, Mr. Holshue. We'll see you.
Thank you.
Coming up.
10 years ago, I can't imagine doing this when I'm 50. Now I'm like, hell yes, 75. Let's do it.
Punk rock in old age, but first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials put on 13 points today. That's 10%. Finished at 15,555. Triple nickel on the blue chips. The NASDAQ added 25 points, 0.7%. 3605 there. The S&P 500 ticked up 4 points, 0.25%. 1690 at the bell. Strong profits for both Dow Chemical, which gained 1.8%, and General Motors, which lost 0.1%. Ain't capitalism great? Visa charged up 4% today. More people pulling out the plastic these days. MasterCard swiped a 1.3% gain. Yesterday's poor earnings dinged Caterpillar again. The equipment maker dumped 1.5%. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note edged down to 2.57%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace Music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. The University of Michigan releases its final July Consumer Sentiment Survey. A House committee holds a field hearing in New York City to discuss how freight transportation challenges in urban areas impact the nation. And the Museum of the Moving Image opens a Breaking Bad exhibit exploring protagonist Walter White's transformation from family man to drug lord. The show's final season airs later this summer. Bummer. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Figures out on the British economy this morning show the growth rate there has doubled. It's some small vindication for the British government, which has been slammed at home and abroad for its tough austerity budgets, social programs in particular. The crackdown on welfare over there, though, has been popular. Welfare recipients excluded. Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports from London.
54-year-old Linda Edwards lives in this rather bleak housing project in South London. She's not celebrating Britain's economic revival.
In Great Britain at the moment, you know, the rich are getting richer and it seems like that they're victimising people that haven't got any money. You know, that's what it seems like.
Linda lives on welfare with her adult son who suffers from arthritis, a condition which she says renders him unfit for work and requires her attention as a carer.
Sometimes people think there's nothing wrong because he'll maybe be moving fast or running around, whatever, and then all of a sudden it'll strike and that's it. And he has difficulty getting about.
But under the government's welfare reforms, she now stands to lose half her benefits as her son's disability is reassessed.
His benefits, what he's getting, are being looked at as well. It's not just people like me who are carers. It's actually sick and needy people as well.
The eyes to the right, 324.
In Parliament, the government has pushed through a raft of welfare reforms. 1.5 million people on sickness and disability benefit are being re-examined. So far, more than 200,000 of them have been found fit for work. The minister responsible, Ian Duncan-Smith, says the aim is both to save public money and help people languishing on welfare.
What we're doing is getting some fairness in the system, getting the bills under control, and reforming a system that lets people trapped on benefit out of work. That has to change. We're changing it now.
The latest reform is a cap on the total amount that a family can draw in welfare. Under the new rule, a household with at least two able-bodied adults may not receive benefits worth more than the national average earnings, about $40,000 a year. Robert Oxley, who campaigns on behalf of taxpayers.
The reason behind the cap is to remove those perverse incentives, which meant it was actually sometimes better to remain on welfare than to go out onto work, and to ensure that the families paying for the system aren't subsidising a lifestyle that they themselves could not afford.
Opponents of the measure say it doesn't take into account the very high cost of housing in London, which could easily absorb the whole of the $40,000. But that doesn't cut ice with these working people who live outside the British capital. They say $40,000 a year in state aid is enough.
You know, I can live on that, so, and I've got a child, and I don't get no help at all.
I think people get too much on benefits. I think to cap it is right.
It's more fair. You shouldn't get more benefit than people who go out to work.
Welfare accounts for a third of all public spending in Britain, $320 billion a year and rising. The government says it's got to put the lid on it, and the voters agree. More than 70% support the benefit cap, and a third of those that don't say it's because the cap should be lower. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
If you've been A, paying close attention to the music in the show today, and B, if you happen to be a fan of punk rock, you might have noticed a theme. All of the music in today's program is either by the punk rock band The Offspring, or it was chosen special just for us by the band's lead singer Dexter Holland. We called him up and invited him on because he is just a crazy busy guy. Multitasking is too soft a word. Besides fronting The Offspring, he's a PhD candidate in molecular biology and an entrepreneur to boot. He runs his own hot sauce company. Dexter, thanks a lot for coming in.
Hey, thank you.
I don't mind saying that talking to you makes me feel about as inefficient and time-wasting as I've ever felt. I mean, do you sleep or what?
You're too kind. Thank you.
No, that's a serious question. It's a time management thing, right, in essence?
It is kind of. You always feel like something's slipping. You know, we're going on tour in Europe in a month, so I ran a few miles this morning.
Good.
And then I'm going to be here with you today. I'm hitting the hot sauce factory on the way back down because it's in Huntington Park. We're making green sauce today, and I'm doing a vocal tonight, so I wrote some lyrics before I hopped in the car to come see you. So
it's a full day.
Yeah, it's a full day, but it's great. Like, man, who gets to do what I do? It's awesome.
You gotta keep them separated.
I wonder how much time you spend with people looking at you on paper or meeting you face to face and not knowing about your other interests, and they say, "Wait, dude, you're a punk rocker? What?"
Oh, right. Don't underestimate us. Yeah. You know, I think they get very stunned when they find out, wow, you do other things or you're educated and stuff. And punk rock is very rebellious, of course, but it also means thinking for yourself. And there's a lot of smart guys, a lot of guys that have had a lot of education, the singer for Bad Religion and singer for The Descendants. And it's kind of a thing amongst some of us.
You were a scientist before you were a musician, really, weren't you? Molecular biology is your thing.
That's right. That's right.
I would ask you to describe your work, but A, I wouldn't understand it, and B, the quote I read about you is, we're trying to slash the tires on HIV, right?
Trying to put in layman's terms,
yeah.
Right? But yeah, there's a lot of ways that people are trying to attack the AIDS problem, and there's different weaknesses in the AIDS virus, like Achilles heels in a way, and I'm focusing on one.
And then somewhere along the line, between all this other stuff you're doing, you say to yourself, I'm going to start a hot sauce business? Gringo Bandito? What the?
It, just one of those dumb things. I'm sitting eating a taco one day, yeah, putting some hot sauce on it, and just thought, why don't I have a hot sauce?
Just, no, come on. Really?
Just like it was like that feeling, like it would be cool to have a hot sauce. I have no idea how to cook anything or make hot sauce, but how about if I just mess around with it for a while and see if I can come up with something?
And you come up with your recipe, and then what do? You go find some seed capital and you know, get some partners, or what do?
No. Come on.
You do it on your stove?
I don't know if you've ever heard of the term DIY. It's an old punk rock term. It stands for do it yourself, because
it's an old punk rock
term. When you started, you had in a band, and no one, you know, you don't go to Capitol Records and get signed. You had to do your own t-shirts and your own flyers, and you had to do everything yourself out of necessity. And the hot sauce was the same thing. I just made it as Christmas presents and gave it out to my friends and some coworkers and stuff. And they were just like really raving their response, like, this is so good, you should sell it. And that kind of got me going. And so I started doing it.
Talk to me for a second about your approach to making your music. It's got to be different now than it was when you were 20. Has to be.
It is, because you can't sing about the same things as you did when you were 20. It would be ridiculous to sing about, I don't know, being in the quad or something like that, right? So really the challenge is how to keep it universal in a way. How can I tap on a feeling that I'm still feeling that other people can feel and isn't just necessarily for 40-year-olds, you know? Can't really write about mortgage payments and stuff like that, but
we would play that song on this show if you wrote a song about mortgage payments.
Right.
I'm here to say that.
But you can talk about, you know, let's make the world a better place, as naive as that sounds, there's always something messed up to write about. That was one of my songs. It was called Stuff is Messed Up, which is sort of a nice way of saying what the words really are.
Yeah, that's not the way I remember that song, but okay. Are you going to be like the Stones touring when you're 75? I mean, not that there's anything wrong with Mick out there. But
I know. I hope so. When I was, 10 years ago, I can't imagine doing this when I'm 50. Now I'm like, hell yes. 75. Let's do it. Actually, you know, we'll do it as long as it's fun. Like I said, we've achieved everything in terms of the selling records and awards and all that we wanted to. And now it's just fun. And if it wasn't fun, I would do something else.
Dexter Holland, thanks a lot for coming in.
Hey, thank you. I do a lot of interviews, and it's nice to not have an interview start with, tell me about your record.
Yeah, well, there you go. Welcome to Marketplace.
Hey. Yeah, no, this has been really fun. Thanks for having me.
Take it easy. We got Dexter to put together a whole Marketplace playlist just for us. Money, theme, and all. Marketplace.org is where it lies.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, in which I think the Senate of the United States fails to fully grasp the meaning of the words representative democracy. Tax reform is in the works, as you might have heard. Recommendations from senators to the Finance Committee as to which tax breaks they favor and which they oppose are due tomorrow. Should you be interested in knowing, however, who prefers what? Tough beans. Chairman Max Baucus and Ranking Republican Orrin Hatch have promised senators their recommendations will be kept secret for 50 years. Each recommendation will be given its own ID number and kept on encrypted password-protected servers. And maybe it's just me. And if it is, tweet at me, write to us, let us know. But isn't this whole idea that they get to do non-national security, non-investigative stuff completely in secret kind of nuts? I don't know. All right, we're done. That's Marketplace from APM. John Buckley, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, George Judson, Jonathan Karp, Ethan Lindsay, Betsy Streisand, and Celeste Wesson are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is Sarah Gilbert. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll meet you back here tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.